We are in Proverbs, the ninth chapter tonight. Proverbs chapter 9. Let me read the chapter, and then we will take an in-depth look at it. Proverbs, the ninth chapter. Follow as I start in verse 1. Wisdom hath builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. She hath killed her beasts. She hath mingled her wine. She hath also furnished her table. She hath sent forth her maidens. She crieth unto the highest places of the city. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. As for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, Come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine which I have mingled. Forsake the foolish, and live, and go in the way of understanding. He that reproveth a scorner getteth to himself shame, and he that rebuketh a wicked man getteth himself a blot. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. For by me thy days shall be multiplied, and the years of thy life shall be increased. If thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. But if thou scornest, thou alone shalt bear it. A foolish woman is clamorous. She is simple and knoweth nothing. For she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city to call passengers who go right on their way. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. And as for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, Stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he knoweth not that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell. We have now for quite a while been in this section that we call, for want of a better way of putting it, a parable of wisdom. It started back in chapter 1, all the way back in chapter 1, verse 7. It now ends at the end of chapter 9. Now, just let your eyes go a little bit forward here. Look at chapter 10, where we have the heading, The Proverbs of Solomon. And so, notice we've had sort of a division here. The actual proverbs that belong to Proverbs, technically, are going to start in chapter 10. We are concluding this long parable that I call it a parable of wisdom. It's a parable that extols wisdom. It's proclaiming the importance of wisdom, the necessity of wisdom, and why you ought to seek it. And so let us review a few little details here, some observations we've been making. Hopefully by now you're sick and tired of these, and you can recite them in your sleep. Because then, good, if you can, you can remember them. Okay, first of all, that wisdom, really, as the Bible uses the term, is a paradigm, a mindset, a grid through which we look at the world. Okay? It is not simply getting the right answer. It is understanding that enables you to come up with the right answer. In other words, it would be like learning a skill, a trade. Charles, use you as a guinea pig here. If you have an intern that works with you in the field of carpentry, that you are training them to be able to be a carpenter. Now, when you're in the early stages, you have to tell them, cut this right here, cut it this long, right? As they progress in wisdom, they are able to determine themselves where I need to cut, how long it needs to be. Do you understand? Now they understand the process. They don't need you to give them a list of do's and don'ts. They can come up with their own list of do's and don'ts. Now that's wisdom. Wisdom is not just the facts. As we've said, wisdom is the skillful implementation of knowledge. It's, you've got to know some things, But just to know some things doesn't make you wise. Wisdom is to be able to use that knowledge in a skillful way. Because of that, by its very nature then, wisdom is not something you can get like that. It is something that you get by putting yourself, as in my illustration a moment ago, under the tutelage of somebody who is wise. You've got to be instructed by somebody that has wisdom for you to ever gain wisdom. And so if we're thinking of an athlete trying to learn how to play football, he puts himself under the tutelage of a coach. If we have talk about a pianist wanting to learn how to play the piano, you put yourself under the tutelage of a teacher. If you want to learn a foreign language, you don't learn it instantly. You have to go through the discipline of understanding how it works. So all of that, I hope by now you've got that down. You don't need me to repeat that anymore. I probably will, but anyway, you may not need it. A couple of other just observations in that the way the Bible approaches wisdom is that the real wisdom leads you to what I call here moral rectitude. Rectitude means right. It's straight. It lines up. And so the idea in the Bible of a immoral man being wise is a contradiction in terms. Real wisdom leads you to moral skills. In other words, the ability to make moral decisions. In other words, you may be very wise when it comes to, patching holes in airplanes. You may be very wise, Charles, at building a cabinet. Jeremy, at building a house. Whatever it is that you have a skill to do. But in the Bible sense of it, if that does not lead you to a moral rectitude, then you're not wise. So it's just a contradiction in terms that you could be a wise man and be an evil, wicked man, as far as Scripture is concerned. The second thing is that folly is not so much the absence of intelligence as it is the absence of morality. The fool, in other words, a man may be very intelligent in many areas of life, but if it does not bleed over to his making right moral decisions according to Scripture, he's not wise, he's a fool. All right? So tonight, let us sort of work our way through this chapter, and it's a very interesting one, and I always say that. When I start looking at this, I'm saying, this is just boring, and how am I going to make this? And then by the time I get through, I'm really into this stuff. I'm liking this. This is very, very interesting stuff. I have never been one to delve very deeply into the realm of philosophy, which is, of course, study of wisdom. And mainly because most of the philosophers I knew, I didn't think they had much wisdom. This past weekend, I read a book by Anthony Flew. That name, anybody recognize the name Anthony Flew? Well, see, you float in the same circles I do, the circles of ignorance. Anthony Flew, till about 10 years ago, was one of the most noted and notorious atheists in the realm of philosophy. And about 10 years ago, he announced that he was now a believer in God. And his book is called There Is a God. It is one of the most interesting reads. If you've got the opportunity to get a hold of it, it's only about $10 off Amazon. One of the most interesting reads. And again, there's a lot in there. He's talking about different philosophers and so forth that if you're like me, I've heard the name. I don't know what they taught necessarily. But it is a fascinating exploration of what was it that caused him to change his whole, literally come out of the closet. It was a huge scandal that this guy, in his later years, I think he's up in his 80s now. In fact, some of them said he just sort of went off the rocker in his old age. And then he wrote a piece saying, no, I'm not off my rocker. I finally found my rocker. But you all know who Richard Dawkins is, very noted atheist, takes him to task on a number of issues. Very interesting reading. And so I've recently worked my way through that book, and it sort of made me rethink the whole importance of this area of Proverbs and the whole wisdom literature of Scripture, because You understand the law is telling you what's right. It's that you do this because it's right. The wisdom literature says you do this because it's wise. So it's you're coming to the same conduct, but you're coming at it from two different directions. You understand? And usually in church circles, we're coming at it from the standpoint of law. You do this because the law says so. But wisdom comes at it from the other angle. You do it because it's the wise thing to do. Anyway, all of that. I'll get off my shoulder. And by the way, there is an appendix. I was telling Janet about this the other day, of that book written by N.T. Wright, and he's not one of my favorite guys. I don't like his view on the new perspective on Paul, but that appendix is worth the price of the book. He does a fabulous job of defending the resurrection of Christ from a philosophical basis. It's the best I've ever read on the subject, bar none. So get it just to read what N.T. Wright says at the end. Okay, there's the advertisement. Get on Amazon or wherever you do your book buying. Where do you do your... Oh, no, I don't want to ask. All right. Let us move into this. The preparation of wisdom. Do you notice, first of all, that wisdom is personified? Wisdom is personified as a woman. Why? Because the word is in the feminine in Hebrew and in Greek. In Greek, Sophia, and we use Sophie as a woman's name. That's where it comes from the word for wisdom. And in Hebrew, the same thing is true. It's a feminine word. I mean, I realize in English we don't, outside of talking about hurricanes or ships, we don't have genders attached to our nouns. But in other languages, they do. So it's very natural for a Hebrew to think of wisdom personified as a woman. And notice that this woman, first of all, the first thing we see here in verse 1 is what I call here the place of wisdom. She has built a house. She's hewn out her seven pillars. The idea is that there is a location where wisdom dwells. And so what does that tell us? If you want to get wisdom, what do? You better go to that location. Right? There's a place. Seven pillars, the pillars that hold up the house, seven being the perfect number in Hebrew. This is a sturdy house, has seven pillars holding it up, complete. So you get the idea that there is a location where you're going to find wisdom. The second thing we notice is that there is a provision. In verse 2, she's killed her beast. Now, this is not talking about killing mass or something like that. This is talking about killing a cow, killing, I wouldn't guess it's a pig in Israel, but it's the idea of killing what it is you're going to serve for a feast. Killing an animal to have for a feast was more than likely a very special thing in Israel. Most of the time they might not have meat, but on a feast day, you're going to kill a beast, a sheep, a goat, or whatever it is that you're going to serve. And notice she has killed the beast. She has mingled her wine. What does that mean? When you mingle something, what do? You mix it up. Well, what do you mix it with? What did you say? Vodka. Yeah. Good guess, Charles. Water. In the ancient world, it was not considered socially acceptable to drink wine undiluted. In fact, I've read arguments about the wine that was eaten at the Passover meal. I'm convinced it was real wine. It wasn't grape juice. In fact, there would not be much of a reason for the ancient world to produce grape juice, mainly because you can't keep it without refrigeration. Wine, that's the whole point of making wine, it can be preserved without refrigeration. But at the same time, most of the time when they drank wine, they didn't take it straight. They mixed it with water. That was for two reasons. It would stretch it out. Well, really, that's the main reason. And the old adage is that long before it affected your head, it would affect your kidneys. So you're unlikely to overdrink. If you are drinking wine mixed with about four parts of water. And so notice she's prepared the wine. She's mingled it. It's ready to go. In other words, the dinner is served. Let's put it that way. The provision is on the table. So here you have wisdom who has built a house. She is serving a dinner in that house. And then notice the third thing here, the proclamation of wisdom. Notice she has sent her maidens out and they cry on the highest places of the city. The idea of the most public prominences in town, her maidens are crying. They're announcing dinner is served over here at the house. So you get the picture here in these first three verses that wisdom, the personification of wisdom under the personification of a woman. And I realize that is not, I guess in modern literature, do we do that very much anymore? But when you ask yourself, what in the English language, what is probably the greatest known work that personifies things, makes people out of concepts? Pilgrim's Progress. That's what Bunyan did. It's an allegory, and you've got people, Christian, faithful, hope. You've got people that have names of concepts, and they're personifying those concepts. It's a very appealing way to tell stories in the ancient world. We've got that going on here. Wisdom is being personified as a woman. She's got a place where she's serving a meal. She has sent her maidens out to announce that supper is served. Okay? This brings us to the next three verses, and notice we've got little triads of verses through here. It's the provision of wisdom. What is it that she is serving? Well, she's serving wisdom. She's serving understanding. That's the idea. Notice in verse 4, she says, "Whoso is simple, let him turn in here. As for him that doesn't have any understanding," in other words, notice the target of her invitation is to the simple. Now, what is simple? When we say somebody's simple, we've had it all the way through this section. What would be a synonym you would use? That's a simple person. Inexperienced. Very good. Naive. Very good. All of the that's the idea. Unskilled. But notice here that we have the additional idea that not only are they naive and unskilled, they know they're naive and unskilled. In other words, we are calling for, it's like saying, okay, all you stupid people, come in here. Now, stupid is not exactly the same as simple now. But you get the picture. We are appealing to a class of people who know they don't have it and they know they need it. Okay? So you're calling out to those, anybody out there need wisdom. And that, by definition, is the simple. Then come in here. Notice, to those who lack understanding, she says to them, verse 5, come eat of my bread and drink of the wine which I have mingled. I have something for people just like you. And notice in verse 6, forsake the foolish and live and go in the way of understanding. In order to come into the house of wisdom, you have to forsake the house of the foolish. We're going to get around to her in a little bit. But in other words, you can't dwell in both houses at the same time. You got to make a choice. Which house you going to go to? If you're going to come into the house of wisdom, then you must forsake the house of folly. Make sense? All right. I wasn't clicking on my clicker. Call to the simple. Her call is to partake. Her call is to turn into her and away from folly. Now, again, the prerequisite of wisdom. It's no surprise that Lady Wisdom, as I say here, operates in a wise manner. Right? Her method is going to be wise. And notice that her method is not to reprove the scorner or the scoffer or to the wicked man. Now, this is sort of fascinating when you think about it. In other words, she doesn't waste her time trying to fill up the guy who's already full. Make sense? I mean, I'm wasting my time trying to teach you something if you already know it all. She's not trying to argue with the obstinate, or as I put it here, she's not trying to wrestle with skunks. We get the idea here in verse 8 that when you enter into controversy with the scorner, with the wicked, you wind up, they hate you. Nothing of any consequence is accomplished. However, you rebuke the wise man and he loves you for it. You see the different outcomes. So in other words, wisdom has a manner of operating that she operates on the one who can be instructed. I mean, have you ever been around somebody you can't tell them anything? Can't teach them anything? They already know everything? Well, I mean, they really don't, but they think they do. And so that's the idea, is that wisdom doesn't waste her time with that kind of person. And so she gives to those who are hungry for her wares, and even to those who have already partaken of her wares. That's the interesting thing about the wise man, scripturally considered, is that the wise man who already has imbibed wisdom is always hungry for more wisdom. In other words, the wise man knows that he doesn't know everything. And that is an interesting feature of a truly wise man, is that he's not full of himself. He's not looking at things as, I've got all the answers. He is still hungry for wisdom. And so verse 9, give instruction to a wise. Why would you instruct the wise man? Notice, he will be the yet wiser. Teach a just man. He will increase in learning. In other words, no matter how far you have come in the process of gleaning and learning wisdom, there's always more to go. I mean, when will we be finished with that? We say, well, when we get to heaven, you know, we're going to know everything. I'm not so sure. I really don't. We'll understand it better by and by, we used to sing, generally at funerals. Well, I think we'll understand a whole lot more, but will we understand everything? You think you're going to have the mind of God when you get to heaven? I mean, you're still going to be finite. He's infinite. So I've got a hunch we're still going to be learning some stuff. We're still going to be exploring things. Hopefully the process will be a little simpler, a little easier. But the point is that we never, ever run out of things to study, of things to learn. The wise man sees that and operates accordingly. All right, now we go to verse 10 through 12, what I call here the paradigm of wisdom. Now, by paradigm, y'all understand that word? It's not a paradigms, 20 cents. It's a system of thought. Ptolemy had a paradigm of understanding the solar system whereby the earth is the middle, the center, and everything, the sun, the moon, the planets, all revolved around the earth. We would have to say that's what it looks like. If I go out there in my front yard and watch, that's what it appears to me. I think I'm stationary. I don't think I'm moving. I don't feel like I'm moving 1,000 miles an hour as the earth rotates on its axis. It looks like to me it's everything else that's moving. And Ptolemy, that was his paradigm, the way he looked at the universe. Copernicus came along and said, no, you got it all backwards. It's the sun that's still, the earth is revolving around the sun. Now, again, he wasn't completely right, but it was a mile of improvement over what Ptolemy was teaching. In other words, all of a sudden, the paradigm shifted. All of a sudden, what does that mean? You're looking at the same phenomena, but you're looking at it through a different grid. You're judging it differently. And so notice here that what wisdom relies on is a paradigm of thinking that is defined here in verse 10. That it is the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom. We've already had that, haven't we? You've heard that over and over again. You'll just keep hearing it through the book of Proverbs. If you want to know what that is, look at the couplet here. The second half of the couplet of this poetry is the knowledge of the Holy, that's the Holy One, is understanding. In other words, for the wise man to be wise, he has to look at life through the grid of understanding God, fearing God, honoring God, obeying God. That's the mindset. And again, back to the idea, it doesn't matter how brilliant you might be in other areas, if you don't have that grid, if you don't have that paradigm, then you're not going to be wise, at least in the sense that the Scripture uses it here. I'm every now and then glancing at my notes. We have a number of illustrations of people that are very, very brilliant. in certain fields. Science. If I asked you who's the smartest scientist you know today, what would you say? Stephen Hawking, that'd be a name. Brilliant guy. How about the smartest as far as making money is concerned? Huh? Buffett? Trump? No, probably not. Gates? Bill Gates? Okay. Brilliant. I mean, obviously, done a great job. They know how to make money. Some of us don't have that gift, right? We exhibit that a lot. These guys do. What other field? How about music? Well, that's too broad, but you can imagine great musicians, talent. In other words, we have intelligent people, talented people, gifted people. But the point is that when it comes down to what the Scripture is defining as wisdom, they may be brilliant, but they're not wise. Now, it almost seems a contradiction to us, but if that brilliance does not bleed over into a mindset that sees God and fears God, and that is what's so fascinating of Anthony Flew's book, is coming from just a notorious atheist to having to admit that I was wrong. I mean, you don't find many philosophers doing that. Now, he still doesn't say that he believes in Christianity, that it is fascinating to read his argument, though, why he had N.T. Wright come and give this appendix at the end of his book was, he said this, that if you're going to argue against religion, Christianity is the one to beat. In other words, of all the religions in the world, it's the one that you're going to have to deal with. It's the one that is the strongest adversary. All the rest of them I can explain away. Christianity? No. That's the one. If I'm going to argue against religion, that's the one I've got to take on. And that's why he had N.T. Wright write this appendix to his book, to be fair, to give him a chance to say what he says. Very fascinating thing. So in other words, what you're seeing there is someone sort of on the process to be able, by wisdom, to recognize that there is a God. Now, Romans 1 says that, that you can understand by your own logic that there is a God. That doesn't mean that makes you a Christian, because what happens, lost man tends to suppress that knowledge, act as if it's not so, pervert that knowledge. But nevertheless, by his wisdom, he can arrive at the basic conclusion that, yes, there must be a God. And that's basically where Flew is today. And yet, notice that what this is saying in verse 11 is that wisdom is the only avenue to really knowing life. Now, here that life is being expressed in verse 11 by your days being multiplied and your years being increased. But if we were to put that in New Testament terms, we find Jesus saying, I came that they might have life and might have it more abundantly. It's not just that they've got longer life. I mean, we have eternal life. That's pretty long. But it's also that it's life of a different quality. And that you can have all of this other stuff. The scientific savvy of a Stephen Hawking. The economic savvy of a Bill Gates. And yet be miserable. Be unsatisfied. That just doesn't seem to work for us. We assume if I had billions of dollars, I'd be the happiest guy on the planet. Right? And experience tells us that's not so. I was reading a book. You remember when we did the study of the book, All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes? Way back there. Fascinating book. I'm giving you just some great reading material here. All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. Very fascinating look at culture. And the guy pointed out an observation. He said back in 500 years ago, the philosophers looked at culture and they said suicide is virtually unknown among the lower classes. And it says their life is miserable. It's drudgery. It's get up and go to work and go to bed and get up tomorrow and go to work. It said where you find suicide is the upper classes. And they're sort of befuddled by this seeming paradox. You would think the guy who wants to slit his wrist is the guy that's got to go shovel dirt all day long. And instead, it's the affluent upper class that gets to sit around and eat dainties all day long. They're the ones killing themselves. Why is that? And I think the answer is right here, is that wisdom is the only thing that's going to give you the satisfaction that you're looking for in life. And you can have all this other stuff, and it just doesn't do it. It doesn't fill that hole, that void. And the rich man, it's like Solomon, who had all of this stuff going for him. And that's what we're supposed to take away from Solomon's life, is the average peasant in Israel didn't have any of those things, and he's got it all. And yet he gets to the end of his life, looks at it and said, it's vanity, all of it's vanity. It doesn't satisfy. It doesn't do it. Most of us are never going to get to know, are we? Let me point out Solomon. He's got riches coming out of his ears. You think money's going to do it? He's got entertainment. Now, the average guy didn't have any entertainment. The only entertainment he has is him whistling to himself. Solomon's got all these singers and dancers in the palace entertaining him. And he said, no, that doesn't do it. Now, the average guy wouldn't even know that. He never has to accept. He thinks, if I could just have what the king has, I'd be a happy camper. And Solomon's saying, hey, take it from me, folks. I've been there. It's not going to do it either. You think chasing women's going to do it? How many wives did he have? 700? How many concubines? 300? This guy's had 1,000 women. He doesn't even have to, you know, 3 a night for a year. You think chasing women's going to make you happy? Solomon says, take it from me. I got all the women I can stand. He said, I've not one among 1,000. Read what he says in Ecclesiastes. Not one among 1,000 have I found that I really love. Now, that 1,000 number, I don't think was accidental. In other words, I don't have one satisfying relationship with one woman out of 1,000. You get the picture. If ever there was anybody who ought, if the world is going to supply what you're looking for, the Solomon ought to say, I'm there, I got it. And instead, he got to that point and said, look, folks, you'll probably never be able to experience what I experience. But take it from somebody who's been there. It doesn't satisfy. And wisdom is saying, look, listen to me, that you can be poor as a church mouse and yet be satisfied in life if you have wisdom. All right, let's go. There is this strange verse, verse 12. If thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. When I first read this, I was thinking I'm reading this wrong. I was expecting him to say, if you're wise, then you benefit everybody. You know, your wisdom bleeds over to everybody else. But notice he says, if you're wise, you're only wise for yourself. And then the corollary is, if you're a scorner or a scoffer, thou alone shalt bear it. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, it seems to me that the scoffer, by his scoffing, influences everybody else around him to be a scoffer too, so it ought to be like his scoffer affects everybody. But Solomon, or the point that's being made here, is that no, both wisdom and scorning are very private matters. Anybody got an insight on that you'd like to share, that ring a bell with you? You reap it for yourself. In other words, you don't get wise riding on somebody else's coattails. It is a private pursuit. In other words, your mom and dad can't do it for you as much as they would like to. They can't make you wise. And the scorner, at the end of the day, his scorning is basically himself. It has affected him and really nobody else. It's his private pursuit of wisdom or scorning. Here they're being used as opposite one to the other. And so that sort of sheds a little light on this very strange verse, reminding us that we can't say, you don't get wise by belonging to the group. You don't join the wise club and suddenly you're wise, you know. Wisdom is a personal pursuit. It's something you've got to seek. Yeah, Charles. The outcome, the reward, it benefits you. It does, and we could make a case that the wise man, I'm thinking later on in Ecclesiastes, for instance, Solomon talks about the man in his wisdom who by his wisdom delivers a city. It's not that others don't benefit from our wisdom, but they don't get wise. It does, our wisdom does not rub off on somebody else. They've got to acquire it for themselves. Interesting thought. Okay. Yeah? You're born into the family of a wise person, and unless you apply yourself to the training, you don't come out wise on the other end. And I think that's exactly the point. You just don't get this by osmosis. It's a discipline. All right? Now we come to perhaps what is the most interesting part of this conclusion to me, because this time, and I realize in the King James you don't see this. Anybody got a ESV? Yes, Janet? Read verse 13. The woman folly. You get the idea that we've got a new personification here. We had Sophie, wisdom. Now we've got a new woman in view, folly. She, in other words, foolishness is now being personified under the guise of another woman. And the description of this lady folly, we had lady wisdom, now we got lady folly. Lady foolishness, okay? Several descriptions, she's loud. Now I realize it says here clamorous, but that's the same idea. She's loud. Janet, what was the next word? Seductive and knows nothing. Seductive is probably not my favorite translation there. Anybody have an ESV? What do you have? ESV, the NIV, unruly is how it's translated in the NIV. The idea is she will not be ruled. She's loud. She's unruly. Now, what's being described here when you describe a loud, unruly woman? Got to watch it. I'll get myself in trouble here. I don't want names. Okay, no names. In other words, it's what am I fishing for here? Is that a complimentary way of describing a woman? I mean, not in my book. We would normally say that is immodest behavior, to say the least, and very abrasive behavior. In other words, notice that this is loud and rude and unruly, unruled by anything. And so it says she's simple and she knows nothing. In other words, she has nothing to serve in her house that she's fixed, that she's come up with. Like wisdom has killed the beast, mingled the wine, she's got dinner on the table. Well, there's going to be something to eat in the house, all right, but it's nothing that she herself has provided. And then notice in verse 14, much like wisdom, Lady Wisdom sent her girls out to the high places of the city to announce to everybody, I've got something for you in here, come in. Notice folly now sits at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city. She's also in a very public place, and she's calling to those who are passing by, to those who go right on their way, is the way the King James puts it. The idea is they're on the straight path. So notice the idea is she's trying to lure them, to seduce them from turning off the, you know, it's interesting that straight has a whole new range of meaning in our day, instead of perverted, twisted. But of course, that's the idea here. She's trying to lure them off of the straight path. And she's in a high place, she's loud, and she's in a very public place, calling out to the passerby who's on the straight path to turn aside. Notice verse 16, whoever simple. Now, notice, that's the same cry wisdom had. To the simple, come in here. Now folly is saying to the simple, turn in hither. In other words, you who are seeking wisdom, come see me. Turn into my house. Well, what does she have to eat in her house? In verse 17, she says to the one who turns in, stolen waters are sweet. And bread eaten in secret is pleasant. We wouldn't say it quite like that. Bread eaten in secret apparently means bread you've stolen, that you're hiding behind the wall, you're hiding out of sight, so no one sees you eating this bread. The waters, notice, are stolen waters. In other words, wisdom over here has gone to all this preparation to provide the works of her own hands for those who would turn into her house. Folly over here is basically saying, come in here, I got some stolen stuff, and you can sit down and eat it. In other words, what folly is saying is rather than you using wisdom to get gain or to imbibe of wisdom, how do we put it? Illicit pleasures are the sweetest. I've told you what Stephen Lee says about the guys out there stealing so they can support their drug habit. And he said they work harder than most people do that's got a real job. They have to go scope it out. They have to go sort of case the joint. Then they have to commit the crime. Then they got to find a place to fence the stolen stuff. And he said by the end of the week, they've worked as many hours as the guy who worked at an honest job. In other words, it's hard work. To be dishonest, you got to go to a lot of trouble. I never had thought about it. You figure, well, you just steal it. No, you got to go jump through all these hoops. But what is it that makes that life appealing? It's this principle, illicit things are the sweetest things. You have other illustrations. Oh, man, think about sex. Forbidden. The new, the novel, the illicit is appealing for the sake that it's illicit. In other words, the forbidden becomes attractive purely for the sake it's forbidden. I mean, when you read about homosexuality, what really goes on, you look at that and you say, come on, how is there an appeal to this lifestyle apart from the fact it's forbidden? I mean, it's got to be. There's just no other way to describe it. Why? What else could you get your jollies from this? And that's just one of many perversions that are out there. Why is it appealing? The appeal is that it's illegal. It's forbidden. It's illicit. And that's what folly is saying. Stolen waters are the sweet waters. They're the best waters. The bread that you eat in secret, that's the best bread. And then notice, so here you got the second woman, folly, who's calling from the public place, calling to the simple, come into my house. I've got this stolen stuff here that you can sit down and enjoy. But notice who you're going to sit down at the table with. See that last verse? But he knows not that the dead are there and that her guests are in the depths of hell. You're going to sit down at the table. Who are you sitting there with? Others who have come and partaken. The dead. Yes, sir. Yep. That's right. You are slitting your own throat, your own wrists, by pursuing this course of action. Laura? Exactly. You could say she's a parasite on the back of the ones who are doing. It's sort of course, we have this thing going on in our culture about a welfare mentality, which is basically being a parasite on productive people. You got the people who are actually producing, doing hard work, but you're just skimming off the top. I recall my encounter with the Children of God in Houston years ago. Some of you old timers remember back in the, well, this was even in the late 60s because I was still in Houston. And it was a hippie group of Christian hippies. I don't know how you describe these guys. And they just hung out in public parks. These particular ones were at a park there outside of Houston and ran into this guy and got talking to him. And I asked him what they did. Nothing. And living in tents and under anything. And I said, well, what do you eat? Well, we go through the garbage dumps, or we, a dumpster diving type thing, or we go beg for handouts at the restaurants. Well, what's your agenda? Well, we don't like the establishment. And I was sitting there thinking, if it wasn't for the establishment, you'd starve to death. Number one, you wouldn't have a public park to live in. You wouldn't have anybody being able to give you any food. If it wasn't for the man, you hate the man's keeping you, but if it wasn't for the man, you wouldn't You die. You're siphoning off of the very people that you hate. What a strange phenomenon. That's what's going on. I think, Laura, you're exactly right. That's what's going on here. And yeah, Oscar, a couple of other places earlier, we've had exactly the same thing. Folly, calling like a prostitute. And I said at the time that, yeah, it's put under the guise of a prostitute, but it's bigger than that. It's the whole picture of being swayed by the world, by the culture, by anything, rather than the fear of God. All right, we've reached a milestone here. We're actually to the end of this first section in Proverbs, and it's been I was saying when I first started looking at this, I was sort of dreading it, and the more I've gotten into it, the more interesting it's become to me, hopefully to you as well. All right, let's set this aside then and spend some time in prayer tonight. We have a number of things.